This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I am Ira Flatow. When the energy crisis of the 70s kept cars off the road, imagine where we might be today, 30 years later, if we had followed the road less traveled. If we had heeded President Carter's warning about our dependency on fossil fuels and taken that opportunity to free ourselves from internal combustion engines and our dependency on oil, especially foreign oil. Today we are more dependent on foreign oil than ever, and we have more at stake than just long gas lines. We have the threat of global warming. Well, that message probably is finally sinking in. There's now talk of weaning ourselves off of oil and adopting a cleaner-burning, greenhouse-gas-free fuel, hydrogen. But is it more than just talk? Are automakers and the oil companies, are they ready to make the huge investments necessary to create that paradigm shift to hydrogen? Or are they just stalling until oil becomes so expensive that economics forces the switch? On the other hand, are environmentalists so eager to sell us on hydrogen that they are making unsupportable claims about how quickly and painlessly we can make that switch? Well, this hour we'll be talking about energy and, in particular, moving toward a hydrogen economy. What would it take? How long would it take it? And what would we have to sacrifice, if anything? Also, what can we do in the meantime to dramatically curb CO2 emissions? Some experts say there's a lot we can do with no new high-tech inventions needed. We'll talk about that. So if you'd like to join our discussion, our number is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. As always, you can surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com. Let me introduce my guests. Stephen Pakala is the director of the Carbon Mitigation Initiative and the Petrie Professor of Ecology in the Department of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology at Princeton University in New Jersey. He joins us from Cape Breton, Nova Scotia. Welcome to the program, Dr. Pakala.
Welcome. Thank you for having me on.
You're welcome. John Turner is a principal scientist at the National Renewable Energy Laboratory in Golden, Colorado. He joins us today from a studio in Denver. Welcome to the program, Dr. Turner.
Thank you, Ira. Good afternoon.
Thank you. Amy Jaffe is the Associate Director of the Rice Energy Program and the Wallace S. Wilson Fellow for Energy Studies at the Baker Institute for Public Policy at Rice University in Houston. She joins us today from Houston. Welcome to the program, Dr. Jaffe.
Thank you, Ira.
You're welcome. John Turner, you write in today's issue of the journal Science that a sustainable hydrogen economy is possible with a sustained, focused effort. What needs to be done to make a hydrogen economy a reality?
Well, we have to do two things, Ira. First of all, we have to recognize and define sustainable energy. And in my paper, my definition of sustainable energy is energy that lasts, that will last millennia. And we already have those sort of energy systems based on the sun. We call them renewable energy systems, but I broaden the term to include sustainable energy systems. We look at those sustainable energy systems, and I would include solar cells, photovoltaics, solar thermal systems, biomass, wind, wave, the kinds of natural phenomena that are just part of our planet and part of our ecosystem, just from the energy from the sun. And geothermal is also part of that. So I look at those and I say, do we have enough energy to supply all the energy needs for a future society, say, you know, 8 to 10 billion people? And the answer is absolutely. There is no question. Solar cells by themselves, it's just arithmetic calculation, but if you assume a certain population in 2050, solar cells by themselves could supply the entire world's energy supply. Now, it would take an array the size of Texas, but nonetheless, the resource is there for us to use, and we have the technologies today that can take advantage of that. So the problem is most of these energy systems generate electricity, and we need an energy carrier for transportation and other things like energy storage, because these things tend to be intermittent, and so that's where the hydrogen comes in.
Hydrogen would store the electricity of the solar cells. Would be storing
hydrogen. Would store the exactly. Yeah. Hydrogen would store the energy. It's a chemical carrier. And hydrogen would store the energy from the wind, from the solar, from the various other technologies. You can generate hydrogen directly from biomass, and then that could be used in transportation and to make sure that we have power when the sun isn't shining or the wind isn't blowing.
Now, when you say we would need, for example, solar cells the size of Texas, You make it You make it almost sound as if it's impossible. Like people would laugh at that kind of. We're never going to have an array the size of Texas. So he's just doing pie in the sky stuff again.
Well, we wouldn't have an array the size of Texas, but we certainly could have smaller arrays all around the world. That's the whole beauty of solar. You know, from villages to buildings. You know, you can have some large arrays in various places around the world. Mm. But, I mean, that's just to show that the, I mean, that comment is just to show that the energy is available for us to use. Clearly, we don't have to use that kind of array. We've got wind. Wind could supply significant amounts, biomass, at least 15% of our world's energy needs. And we have wave energy, geothermal, hydro. We have the point of the comment about Texas is that that's the amount of energy that we get from the sun every day. That could be used if we needed to. And clearly, we have more options.
And with all these options, can you give me a ballpark year where you think this might happen if we wanted to start that today?
Well, you know, it's hard to make predictions about the future. You know, it's going to take, I'd say by 2050, we could have significant amount. There's the wind people, wind industry would like some 20% of our energy worldwide from wind in the next 20 to 30 years. You know, I think that's clearly doable at the growth rate. We're far behind in solar cells. I think we need to really increase our production of solar cells and perhaps also, well, especially the cost. So some breakthroughs need to be done there in terms of getting our costs down. But the technology is there.
Amy Jaffe, how are we going to convince the people who own the infrastructure to change their ways and go in that direction?
Well, you know, it's a very challenging point. In your opening statement, you talked about whether prices would force us there anyway. And at $45 oil and going up, the outlook looks better than if we were at $22 oil. But ultimately, I really think it has to be a national initiative. There are groups of people who have called for an Apollo-style national initiative in science. And though I agree with Dr. Turner, there are these incredible, what I call, timeline barriers. In other words, how long does it take you to transform a society to different infrastructure? How long does it take you to do the science? I mean, the timeline issues, we're talking in decades and not in years. And so it's really important to start focusing on the science today. And people back in the 70s said, oh, you know, we don't want to spend a lot in science because, you know, it takes 30 years. And then in the 80s, when the oil price went down, we cut most of our programs dramatically in terms of science spending. And the result is we're here 30 years later, and we haven't made a lot of progress.
Yeah, that's why I said, imagine if we had, you know, everybody says, like, your timeline, hey, in the next 25, 30 years, we could do it. Well, we're here down the road 30 years later.
Right, I do mention, because Rice University is a leader in this, and Princeton and some of the universities, we have a new area of science called nanoscience, nanotechnology. So when Dr. Turner talks about how large solar panels are, and it's true, to the amount of electricity we need, it actually becomes a land issue, both for wind and solar. People who are green don't often mention that, but there is a huge land use issue. But if we can invest in revolutionary science technologies that utilize nanotechnology, whether that's to have better membranes or better solar panels or smaller this or smaller that, then I think the potential is larger. And another thing that I think we kind of know where the science might be is because material science has changed so over the years. There's the possibility of having electricity lines that could go thousands of kilometers with not as much energy loss as we see today. And that would mean we could produce some dirty energy source someplace else and move it to market in a way where maybe carbon sequestration is possible or some of these other new technologies.
But I hear you saying that if we just leave it piecemeal as it is now, we're not going to make any progress. We need some sort of national or international direction on this and cooperation.
Well, I believe the first step is to have a national direction. And once we would have a national direction, that would give us the position to show leadership by bringing in joint venture partners from Japan or China
and
Europe.
Be more specific when you say a national direction. You mean like the president coming out and saying, we went to the moon this way, that old saw, we can do energy this way.
Correct. Exactly correct. And in a scale, I understand the Bush administration has put some money into hydrogen, and there's some controversy of whether they've taken some of that out of renewable energy spending. But the point is, really fundamentally, how much science spending is required? I think from what my understanding is that the requirements would be something more like a space program. You're going to spend $1 billion a year for 10 years just on fundamental science, and not just doing one pilot project like FutureGen, which is a great project, or Freedom Car, which is a great project, because the kinds of technologies that the professors are talking about that are here with us today are technologies that require huge breakthroughs, especially in storage. Storage technologies.
Stephen Piccoli, you say in your paper in Science that we already have the technologies to reduce carbon emissions drastically.
Yes, that's true. The thing that I think is important to do is to look at the problem that we're trying to solve, or the problems that we're trying to solve, and figure out what the time scale is that the solutions mandate. The problem of energy security is one that's frankly beyond my job grade. It's quite possible that because energy security only involves imported oil, that you could solve it with some relatively simple technological fixes on a time scale of decades or a decade or less. But the problem of greenhouse gas emissions involves the entire energy economy. It involves coal, it involves oil, and it involves natural gas. And the oil, all oil, is only about a third of the total mix, so it's a much larger problem. And at least that problem goes on and on and on and on. And so what we do in the paper that you referred to is take a 50-year time frame, which I think is relevant for any of your listeners who are alive and contemplating a career, your youngest ones out there today, and ask, what would we need to do to rein greenhouse gas emissions in and stop the problem of global warming at a level that at least most international bodies argue would avoid the most serious damages. And it looks to us as though our analysis indicates that the mix of options we have available is enough to solve the problem over that time scale several times over. Hydrogen is an important mix, an important element in the mix there, but it's by no means necessary to do it.
And you mentioned very simple things like just raising the fuel efficiency standards for cars.
Absolutely. You could raise fuel efficiency standards for cars. There are all kinds of things you can do with efficiency, increase the efficiency in power plants. There are ways to decarbonize fuels. There are renewable energies, and there are ways to create carbon sinks on the ground.
And I let me jump in here. Dr. Piccoli raises an outstanding point, which is all of that, in my opinion, as an energy policy person, needs to really be coordinated with a concrete roadmap. In other words, we're doing it all piecemeal, but he's right. We need to set goals and targets. We need to know where we need to be in what year. We need to know what year is it possible to use natural gas as a transition fuel, and when would that require us to import 30% of our natural gas from the Middle East and Russia, so it's not a solution to the so-called oil problem. I mean, we need to lay these things down together so we understand the science that's possible at which time in which fields, so we understand what fuels are going to provide us an escape from emissions and which ones aren't, and that we have a coordinated national policy.
All right, we're going to take a short break and come back and talk lots more about national policy with my guests, John Turner, Amy Jaffe, and Stephen Piccoli. And your questions, stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking about hydrogen future and sustainable energy on this hour with my guest, Stephen Piccoli, who is Princeton University, John Turner at the National Renewable Energy Laboratory, Golden, Colorado, Amy Jaffe at Rice University. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. We've heard a lot about the CO2 sequestration, putting it under the ground. Do we know how to do that already? Whoever wants to jump in can answer that first.
I can answer something about that. We're already doing an awful lot of precisely that. there are several different projects that do exactly that or something like it. There's a technology called enhanced oil recovery, where you inject CO2 in the ground in order to chase oil out of the ground. And that already is done at a scale of tens of millions of tons per year. There are a couple of demonstration projects where they're actively pushing CO2 below ground. There's
so you
one.
Stick it back in a cavern where the oil came from, in a hole in the ground?
Or in a similar formation. Mm-hmm. There's one in the North Sea called the Sleipner Project. It's a huge platform that strips CO2 out of a natural gas stream and reinjects it in a formation beneath the natural gas. And finally, there's in the U.S. alone, we move and store a tremendous amount of natural gas in caverns, in formations below ground, and retrieve it simply to level out price spikes. So we know a lot about how to do that.
John Turner, good idea?
Well, I think we have to remember that putting CO2 down in the ground takes money and energy, and I think that's the point, and I wanted to follow up on what Amy said in terms of a policy. All these new energy systems that we're talking about take money, and they take energy, and we need to very carefully consider what kind of technologies that we decide to spend our money and energy on. We only have so much of this fossil fuel around, and we need to spend it wisely and move to something that's sustainable and long-lasting. So I think CO2 capture is certainly possible, although at this point we have no examples of a total coal plant that produces electricity and no CO2. I mean, that's the Future Gen project, and it's not expected to be fully operational until 2020. And we already have technologies that produce electricity without any CO2, clearly wind and solar cells and solar thermal and those kinds of systems. So I think we need to think very carefully about how much money we have to spend and what technologies is the best way to spend on those technologies.
Now, let me interject here a little politics. There isn't anybody who makes a living off of the sun, and so nobody advocates for the kind of technologies that John is talking about. But there are coal states in the United States that have great political power in a presidential election campaign year, and there are certain states that make money from having traditional combustion engines stay on the road. So we have a problem in our political process in terms of going through the evaluation, not just of what's technically practical, financially practical, economical, and commercially practical, but then you get into when you add the layer of what's the politics of trying to implement what's best for the country as a whole, then it becomes much, much, much more difficult to do.
But there was an article, I think it was in the New York Times a few weeks ago, that talked about, maybe in the Wall Street Journal, I don't remember, that talked about foreign countries who have adopted energy conservation and anti-pollution measures as their policy, looking to buy automobiles, for example, from manufacturers that make fuel-efficient automobiles or low-polluting automobiles. I think China would be one of those countries and is a major player. And the article pointed out that the American car makers are at a disadvantage competing for those contracts because they would have to spend more money to upgrade their cars to be less polluting.
There is no question that the Japanese government had a smarter policy than our government many years ago, where they helped with federal grants the Japanese car companies position themselves to meet just that growing market. They had a vision. They supported Kyoto, ala the fact that Kyoto is a city in Japan, and they decided that having an export product or an export promotion policy where Japanese industry would research and create cleaner technologies, not only in the automotive sector but in other sectors, was going to be best for their country. And it's been a very successful policy, as you say, because even our U.S. car companies now are having to license Japanese hybrid car technology because they couldn't develop those technologies themselves successfully in the right time frame.
Yeah, Toyota's selling Prius licenses, so to speak, for their engines.
Correct.
To American car companies.
Precisely.
It's the 70s all over again, isn't it? It's deja vu all over again.
It is also true, though. It's important to understand that if we're – it depends on, again, the problem that we're trying to solve. But if we're trying to solve a problem like the global warming problem, then I think it's critical to take the best shot that humanity has. And right now we have a portfolio of technologies that is quite diverse. We don't necessarily know, as we learn, which one is going to be the most practical, which set is going to be the least costly, and which, if any, are going to involve unintended, undesirable consequences. And so I think it's really critical to keep the focus on what the problem is, and to let the marketplace decide which mix of technologies makes the most sense.
1-800-989-8255 to the phones, to Tim in Denver. Hi, Tim.
Hi. I'm pretty skeptical about the hydrogen economy hype for the simple reason that I don't see it as very practical. I mean, if you're going to put a usable amount of hydrogen in, say, an automobile, you pretty much have only two options. One is to make it a liquid hydrogen, which is extremely cold and a hazard in and of itself, or to have a compressed hydrogen tank, which in order to get any useful hydrogen amount so you can drive a significant distance, you'd have to have it under enormous pressures, which poses a safety hazard if there's a collision. So I hear a lot of people talking about how much energy is in hydrogen and how we can store it, but I don't see how to do it practically.
Can I jump in on that?
Yes, jump away.
There is almost nothing more flammable than gasoline. And
that's
so
right.
Americans have this image in their head that somehow some alternative fuel might be dangerous, but gasoline isn't dangerous. And it's just because we're used to gasoline, and it's we're used to it.
So a gallon is equal to like a stick of dynamite, isn't it?
Right.
Explosive
so,
power.
Right. So I think the point really in hydrogen, where the hydrogen economy loses me, quite frankly, is what are we going to use to make the hydrogen? If we're going to use oil and natural gas to make the hydrogen, then we haven't solved the problem of what the political situation is going to look like in the Middle East in 10 years. Is it going to be worse than today, better than today? And we haven't solved the global warming problem, right?
Mm-hmm. Might have solved the global warming problem, or at least solved it over our watch.
Right. To me, really, the fundamental question for hydrogen is, what are we going to make the hydrogen from? Because there's actually a huge hydrogen industry in the United States that people are not aware of. We, down here in the Gulf Coast, we're actually transporting hydrogen by pipeline over miles and miles of territory and using it safely. So that actually can be done. The question
People have to remember that 2% of energy right now worldwide approximately goes into hydrogen production.
Well,
this is done on a titanic scale already.
Well, let me begin to answer that question, because if you take a cruise and you go into Copenhagen, you see hundreds of windmills, wind turbines producing 20% of the energy, electrical energy for that country. You hear people, I've been out visiting Golden, Colorado. I've been at the National Renewable Energy Laboratory out there, and I've seen slideshows of how there's enough wind power, for example, in North and South Dakota to produce enough electricity for 40% of the United States, not to mention the offshore, the Great Lakes, and other places. It would seem to me that there is enough wind power to make the electricity that you could use to make the hydrogen, if we just have the infrastructure for moving it around and transportation.
And I would add to that that if I were the king and I could say where federal research dollars go, in the improvement of transmission of electricity wires so we could move products farther and cheaper with less loss would be a great place to see a lot of money invested. And we're not really talking about investing money in that at all.
Yeah.
And it's also critical to understand that if we wait until we understand how to move the electricity around and to store hydrogen more safely than in compressed form and to do all of these individual things, then the global warming problem will be that much more advanced, and we will bequeath to our descendants a problem that's going to be much, much more serious, when in fact we have a portfolio available for us right now that can do the heavy lifting for our generation and bequeath to them a world in which the problem is largely taken care of.
The one thing I want to add to that, though, because Europe has a very, very proactive program to promote renewable energy, but there still are these very stubborn timeline issues where they're going to invest $10 billion you know, over a 10 or 20 year period, and they're you know, trying to get to 20%, right? And mm-hmm. and when you take hydro out of the equation, when you look at all the renewable energy statistics, whether you're looking here or elsewhere, the percentage of electricity that's currently generated in the United States by renewables is actually 1 or 2%. If we doubled it, we only get the 4%. If we triple it, you know, we're not talking about the kinds of scales that are needed. So we have a slogan here at Rice. We say, give me a terawatt, right? And you have to look at, again, when you're building these programs, which I totally agree, it's going to have to take more than one technology, and you're going to have to try to implement it as quickly as possible, because we do have this race against carbon. Still in all, you have to look at what's going to provide the most in the quickest time versus, and what time frames are we really needing to look at. And that's an important part of the process. And that road mapping is really just critical to spending the money wisely, because some of it's going to have to be done on the federal level, because really the energy companies are actually starting to invest money looking at some of these technologies, but not to the tune that can really produce the result.
John Turner, please jump in.
Yeah, I just wanted to point out that 1% that the renewables provide is carbon-free. And that's really we don't have any examples of coal, and we certainly have examples of nuclear, which is essentially carbon-free, but there's other issues, of course. I just want to back up quickly on the hydrogen storage system. GM has been testing a car in Europe that gets about 250 miles on liquid hydrogen, and BMW has been using liquid hydrogen. There's some issues there, and the high-pressure tanks don't give you as much, but certainly those systems can be used in fleet vehicles and in buses and systems like that, and that can greatly reduce our oil imports and any emissions in our cities. And those systems can move things along, and then new technologies like carbon nanotubes or some of the chemical hydride systems that are being worked on and being discussed today could come along down the road and give us the 300-mile range that we're looking for with lower pressures, et cetera. So just to point out that we have vehicles on the road, fuel cell vehicles running on hydrogen in California, actually fueled by PV electrolysis. The Honda system uses PV electrolysis, totally pollution-free in terms of CO2 emissions while it's operating.
I've seen internal combustion engines running on hydrogen with very little modification.
Yeah, well, to really get the best power out of them, you have to modify them significantly. Ford is building an engine that will use hydrogen, and it's especially designed for that. But you don't accrue the great benefits of hydrogen unless you use a fuel cell vehicle, because that's where you get the highest efficiency of the chemical to electrical conversion system. So that's really the way to go.
We're talking about a hydrogen economy this hour. Wait. I have to rudely interrupt and remind you. Everybody, we're talking about hydrogen this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Stephen, go ahead. Sorry.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, except that an internal combustion engine running on hydrogen doesn't have any carbon emissions from it. So right. That although its efficiency is lower than a fuel cell,
steam comes out.
It is available today. And frankly, they're a hoot to drive. They're, you know, if you hybridize and supercharge them, the performance is great. But again, if you put a price on carbon emissions, then in fact the marketplace will decide which of the many options, including hydrogen, is chosen, which ones are chosen. And what we need is a national policy to go beyond Kyoto to put a price on the carbon emissions that will in fact allow us to rein in greenhouse warming and prevent the damages that the best available science says is coming.
Well, let me take that a step further and talk about oil geopolitics. If you look at the cost that it costs the U.S. taxpayer to have, and I'm not talking about having the Fifth Fleet in the Persian Gulf, because we would do that anyway because we have to protect trade in the seas. But if you take the actual just energy oil-related costs of reflagging the Kuwaiti tankers during the Iraq-Iran war and certain costs related to the Gulf War that were oil-specific, we, the taxpayer, are actually paying an extra $4 to $5 a barrel of oil for maintaining those military operations. We pay that in our income taxes. If we came out to Americans and said, we want to put that on a gasoline tax and use the money to spend it in science, and here's the roadmap, everybody would scream and protest, but we're actually paying that money on the security of oil supply. Eventually, we're going to pay that money for the security of natural gas supply because we're going to become a major importer of natural gas. So really, we're not putting all the pieces together and understanding the true cost to society, and indeed, the marketplace won't correct for that because it's a public good. So it has to be done through federal intervention.
Well, we haven't been doing that for years. I mean, we've never done that. We've always considered, you know, we've always said, well, oil is, you know, $20, $30, $40 a barrel, when in fact it's a lot more than that when you put in all these extra factors.
Well, there's no question.
And what it takes to clean it up, too. So it's all been artificially supported for years.
In a way, the federal government is subsidizing the use of these fuels because we have to take care of anything that's related to the security and military support of these fuels, and of course we're going to have to pay for the consequences of any environmental problems that result from the use of these fuels. So it's not free.
And health problems, things like that. You know, it's agricultural problems. Now we're going to have oceanic problems and all kinds of stuff.
Yeah. I'd just like to point out that we do have two examples where the government did step in and change the policies, even though economically it wasn't a win situation. And one is leaded gasoline, basically legislated that out of existence for health reasons. And the second is catalytic converters. Those were placed on cars, again, for health reasons. You can't make an economic argument that the car is cheaper. It's more expensive. But it was necessary. I spent a couple years in Pasadena, and I can sure account for how well those catalytic converters changed the air. So there are two examples where government did step in for health reasons. It did kind of value the externalities, and that's what the kind of thing we need to follow.
All right, we need to take a break at this moment. Come back. We'll talk more with Amy Jaffe, Stephen Pacala, and John Turner. More of your phone calls, so don't go away. We'll be right back. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flato. We're talking this hour about a hydrogen economy with my guests, Amy Jaffe of Rice University in Houston, Stephen Pacala of Princeton University, and John Turner at National Renewable Energy Laboratory in Golden, Colorado. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. I think lots of people want to get in there and talk about what we're talking about today. So let's go to the phones. Let's head out to William in Louisville. Hi, William.
Ira.
I'm sorry, it's Louisville.
Yeah, that's fine.
There you go.
Great show you're doing today.
Thank you.
I wanted to say I've heard some rumors, but no details, that that it's going to be the big oil companies that are developing all the new hydrogen technology, and that in some ways it's just as polluting or more polluting than the current oil technology we have now. And I was wondering if any of your guests could comment on that. And also, I would like to hear them talk about a technology that's currently in use in some places, which is the biodiesel. And I can take the comments off the air.
Okay, thanks for calling.
Thank you.
John Pacala, your company, your study was funded by, Stephen, I'm sorry, Pacala, your funding came from one of the oil companies. Was it BP?
BP.
Are they for real?
You'll have to ask them that.
And that's one of the questions, you know, I think he's making the point. Are the oil companies are they serious about this? Or, you know, or are they really trying to still, you know, I imagine, you know, just put it off until oil gets to be so expensive because it is the cheapest thing to do? It's good business.
Now, it's good business for oil companies to consider alternative technologies and businesses, because these companies are you've got smart people in these companies, and as these articles talk about, it's not just about the oil supply, which, believe me, they're having trouble getting access to invest in oil supplies in many different places around the world. but it's also about will they have environmental laws that will mean that they need to be positioned in new technologies. The big companies understand that. You see them investing billions of their own money in things like carbon sequestration and hydrogen technologies. I do disagree with the caller in. I think if you're going to go into a business like hydrogen, there are some companies that understand the environmental issues, and they're looking to do it in a way that is environmentally friendly. The question really is, a lot of the companies see oil or natural gas as the so-called quote-unquote transition fuel.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't have a lot of the companies spending money to figure out how to get this hydrogen from solar, or spending how to get this hydrogen from wind. And I think that that's an issue. In other words, for our nation's future, renewable energy definitely needs to be considered. There are some companies, Shell and BP in particular, that have, you know, taken a stab at solar businesses and are looking at wind and looking at this advanced technologies for clean coal. So it's not like none of the companies are looking at that, but I think as a matter of business, if there's, as we earlier discussion talked about, if you're going to have key countries, maybe it's going to be the United States, maybe it's not, but if to sell in Europe and to sell in China or other places, you're going to have clean energy technologies, then it behooves the company that's a smart company to position themselves to be in that business. And I'll take it a step further, because no one ever talks about the great masses. There are 1 billion people on this planet who are still picking up traditional fuels, sticks, dung, and burning that in their homes because they have no available energy resource that's cleaner or readily available that they can use. So we have basically a third of the planet living in poverty because it's very hard to develop an economy without energy, modern energy. And so that's yet another reason, besides global warming and besides besides oil security, to really be looking at it.
Ira, if I could, I'd like to try to answer the caller's question. The question was whether or not making hydrogen from fossil fuel is just as polluting as using the fossil fuel by itself. And the answer is yes, unless you do something with the CO2. Currently, when you make hydrogen, you usually make it from natural gas, and there's a very simple chemical process that leaves you with an amount of hydrogen, an amount of concentrated CO2, the primary greenhouse gas. And the question is whether or not you could dispose of that CO2 away from the atmosphere where it would do no harm. Now, if you could do that, then, in fact, you could have a hydrogen production from fossil fuel that would be environmentally benign. And that's the idea of carbon sequestration, which is the subject of intense activity around the world. I also think it's important to know that if you're going to solve the carbon and climate problem, that is the greenhouse warming problem, we're going to have to freeze greenhouse gas emissions where they are now for about 50 years. And still, the energy growth of the world is going to continue to grow. And it's going to approximately double over the next 50 years. And that means that we face building, if we're going to solve that problem, we face building an infrastructure which is not carbon emitting, which involves renewables and all kinds of technologies, that is as large as the energy infrastructure today. And companies who've looked hard at the science of global warming and become convinced that it is inevitable that this problem has to be solved would be crazy not to be serious and for real about doing something to compete for that gigantic new market. And so, yeah, they're for real. Their interests are their interests of their shareholders. They have little old ladies who have pensions, and they're trying to provide the largest possible return that they can. But what they see when they look into the future is a future in which this problem is solved. And so they have to invest in technologies that will allow them to be part of that new game.
Dr. Jaffe, hold on. Let me get a comment from John. Go ahead. He's been trying to jump in there. John?
Well, there's a couple of things, points I wanted to make, and I appreciate Amy's discussion of the developing world, because I think that's where the renewable technologies really can provide a very, very different type of scenario. We often forget the renewable technologies are smaller systems when ganged together can provide large amounts of power. So you have wind turbines, small wind turbines, but you have a large wind farm. You have smaller solar cells, but you put them together in panels and arrays, and you can generate significant amounts of power. And you can do that at the place where the villages are. For example, NREL has done some stuff in Brazil and put small solar panels on top of the roofs of a remote village. You come back a year later, and they all have television sets. Now, that brings up another point. And television sets are pretty sophisticated items, but because they're mass-produced, the costs have come down. And that's just what I believe that renewables can also be can also come along with that. You accrue the advantage of mass production and the cost advantages of mass production. If you build a car one-off, like a Lamborghini or something, it's $300,000-$400,000. If you mass produce them, they're $10,000-$15,000. And I noticed Steve in his paper in Science talked about 4 million turbines, wind turbines, to do electrolysis to replace fossil fuels. Well, we build 50 million cars a year, 50 million cars a year worldwide. So building 4 million wind turbines is not you know, an impossible task.
And I think the mechanics is not much different either.
They're mechanical devices. So I think we often forget that instead of building these single large coal plants with sequestration and whatnot, mass production can bring the cost down of these renewables significantly. And when we can offer China, which has large coal reserves, an alternative to building coal plants, we can go into India and Bangladesh and the other developing nations in Africa and offer them these lower cost systems. I mean, if villagers can buy television sets, we ought to be able to figure out the same kind of mass production systems for these renewable technologies.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Jaffe?
Let me just step in here on the question of the hydrogen vehicles, because it's actually a little bit complicated and there's some nuances. It's true Dr. Pakala said, but in the end, if you run more efficiently, in other words, if I have a 30% efficiency gain, then I have it might not be 30%, but I have a certain amount of emissions gain because I don't have to run my car as much with as much fuel to get the same distance, right? So it is true that if I use a hydrogen vehicle, even if I don't have a sequestration technology or some CO2 capture technology, that I'm still ahead of the game. And that brings me to a second point, which is that Toyota itself did a study, a very interesting study, where they found that they did a full cycle analysis of carbon emissions. And by full cycle, I mean how much carbon do I produce making the cars, including that, together with how much carbon do I produce when I use the car. And what they found was that their hybrid diesel, low sulfur diesel vehicles produce much less carbon than even these hydrogen fuel cell cars. And that actually, that from a carbon standpoint, not necessarily an oil security standpoint, but from a carbon standpoint, even if here in the United States and in Europe and in Asia, we were just to switch to these low sulfur diesel hybrid cars with, you know, like you saying, technologies that exist, we could make huge progress just on CO2 emissions from the transport sector.
Mm-hmm. 1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let me see if I can get a phone call in before we have to go. Let's go to Bruce in Kansas City. Hi, Bruce.
Hi.
Hi, go ahead.
Okay, well, I just wanted to make a couple comments, and I'll try to make them as brief as I can. First of all, several of the comments that your guests have made simply don't wash. Number one reason for this is, for example, the gentleman guest that you have has said, well, we have to keep in mind that there's only a certain amount of money to be spent on this, and of course there are politics, and then the lady guest has said that, they have to keep in mind that we're spending so much money on the security of our oil resources and so forth in the Persian Gulf. Well, here's why that doesn't wash. First of all, let's take, in the last 2-3 years, we've appropriated some $186 billion for a war, which may or may not have been justified, but could have just as easily been spent. I mean, this was money that was appropriated. I mean, basically, they said, we're going to spend it, and it was spent. And
so you're saying we have the money if we want to spend it.
Basically, yeah.
Yeah. All right. Let me get a comment. Let me first remind everybody that I'm Ira Flatow, and this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Amy, want to comment?
The same money we spent on the war in Iraq, if we had spent it on renewable energy, we would need no oil from Iraq anymore. That is true.
Hear, hear. We have the money. We have the technology. All we lack is the decision to solve this problem.
Which brings us back to the full circle to the point Amy made at the beginning about having a national will or a national leadership to set a plan in motion. Is that, would I be summing that up right? Did I sum it up right, Dr. Jaffe?
I think that really truly sums it up. I mean, really, how do we get to the moon? We got to the moon because we had a president with that vision. The fact that after we tried to go to the moon, the Russians also were trying to go to the moon, and they also developed technologies to get to the moon and so forth, and now we collaborate. Well, that can give you an idea. If three nations were competing to have an incredible energy system, just think globally what that would mean.
But the president might argue, he's not here to argue it, that, you know, I have a national policy because I've heard his staff argue this. We have a national policy. It just doesn't match your vision of it. We're going to let, you know, use a sequestration of carbon and turn coal into hydrogen eventually. It will may take a little longer, but we'll get there.
He's got one project that's going to take 20 years. That's not fast enough, and it's not proliferating, and it doesn't do the full job. And as Dr. Turner said, there has been some science, no offense to our other guest, that shows that a lot of the carbon, or some of the carbon, at least some percentage of the carbon, is leaking back out. So the point is, it's what I said before. No one has sat down and made an integrated policy, integrated with what can we do right now? What kind of car regulation do we need to have right now? What kind of science program and what roadmap, right, and how do we interact everything together? Right. What are we going to do now? What are we going to do for 10 years? What are we going to do for 30 years in science? There isn't an integrated policy, and it has to be an integrated policy that takes leadership, because there are a lot of particular groups out there that want something special for their state.
All right,
and there are industries that want something special
Jaffe,
for their industry.
We've run out of time. We'll pick this up again and talk more about it. Thanks to Dr. Amy Jaffe, Associate Director of the Rice Energy Program and the Wallace S. Wilson Fellow of Energy Studies at Baker Institute for Public Policy at Rice University, John Turner, Principal Scientist at the National Renewable Energy Laboratory in Golden, Colorado, Stephen Pakala, Director of the Carbon Mitigation Initiative and the Peachy Professor of Ecology in the Department of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology at Princeton University in New Jersey. Thank you all for joining us this hour. Our program is produced by Ned Heist, Erica Altman, and senior producer Karen Vergoth. Charles Berquist is our web producer, and we had help today from engineers Leslie Gaston in Denver. Surf over to our website if you want to leave us mail, and you can also get back editions of Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.